Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Today is the first day of this year's Hajj, the largest annual pilgrimage in the world, which this year is expected to be the biggest ever, according to Saudi authorities. Every able-bodied Muslim is expected to participate at least once in their lifetime, and estimates are that roughly 3.4 million Muslims were in Mecca today to participate in that holy event. They came from all over the world, of course, speaking different languages from an estimated 181 countries. Bet you didn't know there were 181 countries. Can you name all the G20? Never mind 181 countries. But our next guest is seeking to highlight diversity through a collection of works by poets and writers from around the Middle East. Reza Aslan, Associate Professor of Creative Writing at the University of California at Riverside, an author of No God But God, has edited the new anthology, Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East. He'll also be doing a number of appearances around the New York area, talking about things from interfaith understanding through literature to Park 51 reevaluated. So we'll bring up a number of those things as well. Reza Aslan, so nice to have you in our studio after speaking to you on the phone several times on the show.
Yeah, it's great to see you face to face, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And I guess many people think of the Middle East as one entity, and though or Israel and the rest of the Middle East.
Right.
And those who paint Muslims with one brush ideologically are also painting them with one brush culturally. But I think the works in your anthology show a great diversity as well, both politically and culturally. Is that the point?
Absolutely. This is a mosaic region. I mean, full of different ethnicities, different cultures, different religions, different nationalities, sometimes even within one nation state. In this particular selections, we have works translated from Arabic, from Turkish, from Urdu, from Persian. Some people would even say that when you're talking about Turkish and Urdu, they don't even belong in the Middle East. And an argument could be made for that, certainly. But really, what I'm talking about when I say Middle East is sort of what the original colonialists talked about when they said the Middle East. Because, of course, this is just a made-up region. I mean, it's meant to emphasize that which is not the West. In fact, I sometimes even jokingly refer to it as, quote-unquote, the Orient, like they used to say in the 19th and 18th centuries.
Right. That which is not the West, but is not China and Japan.
But it's not China and Japan, yeah. And so you're right. I think that attitude towards this region for hundreds of years has created this perception that it's all sort of the same, when in reality there is so much diversity, so much eclecticism in this region. It's a panoply of cultures and peoples.
And you've collected literature from writers ranging from Orhan Pamuk to Khalil Gibran, who's Christian.
That's right.
And beyond. You're going to do a few very short readings for us.
Well, so one of the things that I wanted to do in putting this book together is not just create an anthology, but to write a whole new way or to present a whole new way of thinking about a history book. So if you're talking about the history of the last 100 years of the Middle East, which is where these works come from, they're put together in such a way as to tell the story of this region, not in the words of colonialists or conquerors or academics or outsiders, but through the words of the region's own poets and writers. And when you do that, what you see is this sort of overarching narrative forming in which these writers, very early on, the first pieces start in about the 1910s, very early on lay the philosophical groundwork, the intellectual groundwork for independence and freedom from colonialism. And help to really found these new nation states of the Middle East, only to discover very quickly that they become the enemies of the states that they helped found very quickly. And I guess the first reading that I would like to do very quickly is from the great Turkish poet Nazım Hikmet, probably one of the greatest Turkish poets of all time, whose words and whose writings really helped fashion a distinct Turkish identity at the end of the Ottoman Empire, but then who very quickly was thrown into prison by Ataturk when the new Turkish state was founded. And languished there for 10 years, actually. And I'll just read the last stanza here from his great poem, Since I Was Thrown Inside. Since I was thrown inside, the earth has orbited the sun 10 times, And just as passionately, I repeat what I wrote the year I was thrown inside. The people who are plentiful as ants on the ground, as fish in the sea, as birds in the sky, who are cowardly, courageous, ignorant, supreme, and childlike. It is they who crush and create. It is but their exploits sung in songs. And as for the rest, my 10-year incarceration, for instance, it's all meaningless words. What's really interesting about the writers of this region is something that we've kind of lost track of here in the U.S., which is the writer as troublemaker. The writer is revolutionary. For a lot of these nation states, you know, these are not places where you have freedom of speech. These are not places where you have freedom of the press. And so the only mirror that society has, the only voice of the marginalized and the oppressed, is the poet's voice.
And it's interesting that that particular story, which most of our listeners probably never heard before, about Hikmet, he was critical of the Ottoman state, but then even after Turkish independence, as you said, he was still treated as an enemy of the government.
Yeah, this is a story that you see over and over again throughout the region, right? I mean, these are the people who really gave shape to a distinct Persian or Arabic or Turkish or Pakistani identity. They're the ones who created the very concept of that identity through their words, through their symbols, through their poetry and writing. And then when those states came to be, when independence actually happened, they turned their pens against their own religious and political leaders and forced them to live up to the promises, the failed promises that they made. And when they did that, they very quickly found that the state that they helped give birth to was sometimes worse than the state that they helped push away.
Did that happen, in your opinion, and is there writing to reflect that? In the case of the country of your heritage, you're Iranian American, and everybody wanted to get rid of the Shah, or most people did, but maybe they didn't expect they'd wind up with the kind of state that they have now.
That's right. In fact, that's probably the best example of it. You know, the writers, particularly the Iranian writers, poets like Farukh Farrokhzad and Ahmed Shamlou, and essayists like Jalal Ali Ahmed, who wrote perhaps one of the most famous third world anti-imperialist tracts ever written. It's called West Toxification, really laid the intellectual groundwork for pushing the outsiders and the Westerners and American domination, in this case, out of the country. And I'll just read the first paragraph of this very famous essay by Jalal al-Ahmed called West Toxification. I say that West Toxification is like cholera. If this seems distasteful, I could say it's like heat stroke or frostbite. But no, it's at least as bad as sawflies in the wheat fields. Have you ever seen how they infest wheat? From within. There's a healthy skin in place, but it's only a skin, just like the shell of a cicada on a tree. In any case, we're talking about a disease that comes from without, fostered in an environment made for breeding diseases. Let's look for the characteristics of this disease, its cause or causes, and if possible, a cure. And then what follows is this entire brilliant tract about how Iranians, and indeed Middle Easterners in general, have been infected by the West. They have mimicked the West. They have made themselves pawns and puppets of Western powers, and that they have to push away from that and create a sense of independent identity. And indeed, that's precisely what Iran did in 1979. A revolution was put in place. The Western-backed Shah was thrown out. And for a very brief while, for a few months, a flowering of a constitutional democracy, indigenously Iranian, yet dedicated to, you know, human rights and pluralism, arose in Iran. But only for a very brief while. And the religious leaders, the clerical oligarchy, as we all know, was able to take control. And people like Ali Ahmed became the enemies of the new Islamic Republic.
So how much do you think this feeling pervades various countries in the Middle East? Because whenever I talk to Iranian Americans, it seems, the feeling is, gosh, I have no use for the mullahs and, you know, Ahmadinejad and the kind of theocracy that they're trying to run there. On the other hand, I really don't like American foreign policy with respect to Iran, which seems to push them away from us. So they're kind of caught in between.
There really are. Something very strange exists in the Middle East, and that is those countries in which the United States has normalized relations with, Egypt, let's say, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, are countries in which the population absolutely loathes us, hates everything about America, American foreign policy, American culture, everything. Those countries where we don't have a relationship with, Syria and particularly Iran, the population loves America, loves everything about American culture, not American foreign policy, as you say, which indicates the sort of disruptive role that we have in these regions. In Iran, of course, it's very easy to place the blame for society's ills on your leaders. You can't really blame the United States for it because the U.S. doesn't really have a hand in what's going on in Iran. But what's important, I think, for Americans to understand, the greatest lesson that we can learn about this region is to differentiate the people from the leaders. That's something we don't do very well. The people in the region do that very, very well. Even at the height of the Bush administration and the war on terror, you could ask any Egyptian, any Iranian, any Turk on the street, and they would say, well, of course America's government doesn't represent American people. But when we look at that region, and maybe we've started to change that attitude a little bit with Iran because of the demonstrations that happened last year, we see the people and the leaders as one in the same, and that is absolutely mistaken. And that's what this literature, I think, really brings up.
So that's a tough political choice for American leadership to make, to not support the government of Egypt, let's say, when Egypt is one of the peacemakers with Israel in the Middle East. Egypt is fighting its own Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic radicals. Mm-hmm. Egypt is, supporting U.S. access to Middle East oil, all of these things. And yet you're suggesting to turn away from the Mubarak government because it's an autocracy.
This is the other thing.
Actually turn the Egyptian populace more toward us.
Right. And this is the other thing that Egypt does. It randomly arrests, tortures, and murders its own people. It allows for absolutely no freedom of speech, no freedom of press. It's under a permanent status of emergency law that allows the government to arrest anyone for any reason for as long as they want to. And it's got a quote-unquote president who's been president for almost 40 years and who's grooming his son to become the next president. When you ask the people on the street in Egypt, what do you want more than anything in the world? They say what almost everyone in the Middle East says, which is, we want democracy. We want to be able to choose our own leaders. And the thing that's stopping us from doing that is not so much our government, but the United States and the $2 billion we give Egypt.
Then was there more tension around the region than most Americans may think in popular circles over the Iraq war? Because America used to prop up the dictator Saddam Hussein, who slaughtered many of his own people when he was considered our bulwark against Iran.
That's right.
And then the U.S. turned on him because he turned on us. If the U.S. was going to overthrow him, and President Bush had what he considered a democracy agenda, where he at least started to talk back to Egypt, to talk back to Saudi Arabia, and start this constitutional process in Iraq, however highly imperfect. Some people like that more than we might imagine.
Shockingly, the people in the region were absolutely elated by Bush's quote-unquote democracy promotion. We in the United States mocked it. We made fun of him. We said he was ignorant. We said he has no idea what he's talking about. How could democracy possibly arise in this region, et cetera, et cetera? If we allow people to vote in Egypt, well, then the crazy fundamentals will take over. And then once the fundamentalists take over, then Egypt will become just like another Iran, all of which is total BS. But what happened in that very brief flowering of democracy is that people around the region actually took the president at his word. And Egypt is a perfect example. We sent Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to Cairo, and she told Hosni Mubarak, you are going to have to let someone, after five elections running for president, you're going to have to let someone actually run against you from now on. You're going to have to actually allow for democracy to flourish in this region. And it did. It was remarkable. I mean, you had Magazines like The Economist talking about the new spring in the Middle East and how the entire balance and the way that that region works was changing. But of course, as you well said, once we realized, wait a second, the people that we like aren't the ones who are getting the votes, we put an end to it. And that was a massive mistake.
Reza Aslan, my guest on WNYC. He's a creative writing professor at the University of California, Riverside, but also obviously with his head in global culture and global politics, and has edited the new anthology, Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East. Obama has also not rejuvenated that democracy agenda, correct?
No, in fact, he's almost got he's allergic to the very word democracy. Of course, you know, he gave his much lauded speech to the Muslim world from Cairo, from, you know, one of the least democratic places, you know, in the Middle East. And in that speech, that 90-minute speech, which was full of very remarkable things that he said the word democracy once in 90 minutes. Now, here's the important thing, is that mention got the loudest and longest applause line of the entire speech. And I think most of us were hoping that Obama was going to take that back to Washington, D.C. and sit down with his advisors, who themselves are allergic to anything that smacked of Bush, and say, actually, maybe these people really do want a say in their political leaders. Maybe they actually do want a voice in who leads them and what kind of government they want. And maybe we should actually start promoting that, but in a smart and legitimate way. But thus far, I haven't seen any semblance that that's what's going on in Obama's mind.
Now, when Obama gave that Cairo speech, you argued at the time that he missed an opportunity by not giving it, this first major address as president, to the Muslim world or from a Muslim country, from Indonesia. Why is that? And do you think he made up for it with his trip there last week?
Because the Middle East is no longer the center of the Muslim world. There are more Muslims in Indonesia than there are Muslims in the entire Arab world. Indonesia has a thriving democracy, a commitment to pluralism in which religious minorities have the same basic rights and freedoms as everybody else does. They have a booming economy, one of the highest, fastest growing GDPs in the world. In a sense, when you look at what is Islam, where is Islam going to be centered in the 21st century? It's no longer going to be in the Arab world. It's no longer going to be in the Middle East, where it's become sort of stunted and drained of any kind of innovation. It's going to be in Turkey and in South Asia and in Southeast Asia. And it's also going to be in Europe and the United States. I mean, the truth is that the center of global Islam is beginning to shift westward, northward and westward, while at the same time the center of global Christianity is beginning to shift southward and eastward. So we're going to have to get used to a century coming up in which America is going to have more Muslims, Europe is going to have more Muslims, in which the sort of center of Islamic learning and exciting experiments in Islam and democracy and modernity is going to be happening in the margins of the Middle East. But at the same time, the Middle East is where we're at. That's where the wars are. That's mm-hmm. where the conflict is. And that's why it's important that we know these people.
Although really, as well as in Asia with Afghanistan and Pakistan. Right. Before you go, this Wednesday at, at 7 p.m., you will be speaking at a discussion co-hosted by Columbia University's Muslim Students Association and Hillel, the Jewish Students Organization, called Park 51 Reevaluated, Reza Aslan on Islamophobia and Anti-Semitism. So, of course, Park 51 is the proposed Islamic Community Center in Lower Manhattan. How will you reevaluate it?
Well, look, I think, you know, now that the elections are over and now that some of the hue and cry about, the Park 51 Center has died down, I think it's time to sort of stop and talk about where that came from. And it's not just about this one building in this one spot. It's about a growing anti-Muslim sentiment in this country that is at unprecedented levels right now. And that is very much a response to a kind of identity crisis that we're seeing in the United States and a sense of the changing political and racial landscape. There are a lot of Americans who are quite nervous about what it means to be American and, more importantly, what America means in the 21st century. We're not the country that we were in the previous century any longer. We are no longer the economic and cultural powerhouse of the globe. And I think that that's created a sense of crisis in a lot of Americans where they're trying to figure out what it means to be American. And in these kinds of times, which we've had many times in the past, the answer seems to be find some outsider, find some group to identify yourself against. And currently, it seems that that other seems to be Islam and Muslims. For many, many Americans in this country, what it means to be American means not being Muslim. And that's something that I think Jews can really identify with, because we saw the same thing in the early 20th century with Jewish immigrants in this country. It's something Catholics can identify with. We saw this very much in the late 19th century with Catholic immigration into this country. It's something that we do in this country. And I very much expect that in 20, 30 years from now, we'll look back at sort of the anti-Muslim bigots we see today, the same way we look back at the anti-Jewish and anti-Catholic bigots.
But does that description of defining yourself as American by not being Muslim ignore 9/11 too much? Wouldn't it be the position of most non-Muslim Americans that they don't really care what religion people practice one way or another? This wasn't a big thing before 9/11. With about as many Muslims in the country as there are now, it's that there's this violent slice of Islam at the moment, which is actively waging war with the West and with other religions. And when they stop or are defeated, hardly anyone will care about where mosques are built or these personal choices people make.
Well, look, we're at war with two organizations, a non-state entity called Al-Qaeda and a state entity called the Taliban. But when you listen to the rhetoric, for instance, when you have Newt Gingrich saying, you know, they killed 3,000 Americans and now they want to build a mosque at Ground Zero, that's a very clear-cut statement. It's American Muslims who are—
Clearly, that's a purposeful conflating.
And that's by the GOP presidential frontrunner. It doesn't get any more mainstream than that. That's the standard rhetoric here in this country. Instead of recognizing that we're actually at war with an organization, people in this country think that we're at war with an entire religion. And that's just, I mean, that in and of itself smacks of bigotry, but it's also dangerous because as, you know, the National Security Advisor and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense and the commander of our troops in Afghanistan have told us, this kind of rhetoric actually makes us at greater danger from these groups that we're at war with.
Well, that's Newt Gingrich, but average Americans hear about radicalization that takes place within some mosques in the U.S., quote-unquote homegrown terrorism, which to some degree is real and to some degree occurs within mosque communities that they considered moderate in the past. And so they don't know which ones to trust, which ones not to trust.
There is a problem of radicalization, of homegrown radicalization in the United States and in Europe, though it's not in mosques. That's an FBI fact. The mosques are not a place of radicalization. On the contrary, the mosques are places of conservatism. The mosque is the answer to radicalization. These people are radicalized outside of the mosque in, you know, small groups and small communities. In fact, they identify themselves in opposition to the mosque. And they need to be addressed. They need to be addressed by the criminal justice system. They need to be addressed by the American Muslim community. And I think that is happening. But I think equating, you know, these small groups of radicals with the 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, that's not just ridiculous, it's dangerous. It would be like saying that, you know, every Catholic priest is a child molester. Nobody would say something like that.
All right. Reza Aslan, author now of Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East, obviously editor of that collection of pre-existing writings from the last century or so, and his upcoming appearances. We mentioned Park 51 Reevaluated, Reza Aslan on Islamophobia and Anti-Semitism. That's Wednesday night at 7 at the Held Auditorium at Barnard Hall. That's 117th and Broadway, and that will be co-hosted by the Columbia University Hillel, the Jewish Students Organization, and the Muslim Students Association. And then on Thursday, there will be a reading and discussion about Tablet and Pen at the Asia Society starting at 6:30 p.m. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Brian. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. And still to come, Philip K. Howard on tort reform as a step toward deficit reduction. It was one of the things in that Deficit Reduction Commission chairman's plans last week. And then we'll have some highlights from the Charles Rangel House ethics trial, which is underway right now. We are listening in and collecting excerpts, and we will give you a thorough update on the Rangel ethics trial coming up. Stay with us.